In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Washington is the moral cesspool capital of the world. We've got one party, the Democrats, perfectly okay with putting pornography in schools and making it available to kindergartners. We've got the former Democrat President Obama issuing statements in support of the American Library Association's efforts to do so. I never in my life expected to see that. And I certainly never expected to see pornography from the current Democrat president's son's laptop on display in a congressional hearing. I definitely did not have that on my life bingo card. Thankfully, the worst of it was blurred out, but some images appear to show Hunter may have been part of child trafficking. Again, I never saw that coming 10 years ago. Naturally, the congressional stunt by Marjorie Taylor Greene got the Democrats all upset. The same party that is okay with giving pornography to children. And the images in those books aren't blurred. Which means the pornographic images of Hunter that got Democrats all in a tizzy, those images are actually less explicit than the books the Democrats want children to have access to. As I said, Washington, D.C. is a moral cesspool. And when the people who govern society have no morals or ethics, guess what they'll do with the nation's money? Because they don't have the moral or ethical breaks to stop. Fraud, corruption, graft, bribes, kickbacks, none of that matters anymore. Unless it gets exposed, and even then it doesn't really matter, because the corrupt media that gets millions in political ads has your back. And who's going to do something about it anyway? The guy next to you who just submitted a $200 million pork project for his biggest donor? You don't try to knock over the buffet table until after you've been kicked out of the restaurant, and by then it's too late. So when it comes to things like evidence that Joe Biden took bribes from foreign countries during and after the time when he was vice president, what has the Democrats most upset? That the evidence has been exposed, or just that it's been exposed in congressional hearings? Shouldn't the fact he did it be what bothers people, or are they guilty of doing it themselves? Well, you can decide that. But these are the people in charge right now of our country and of our country's money, which used to be your money. Welcome to Bidenomics, where it's hard to tell if it's the lack of morality that drives the spending or whether it's the spending that drives the lack of morality. In either event, God help us. To talk about Bidenomics and a whole lot more, I'd like to welcome Jonathan Williams back to the show. He is the American Legislative Exchange Council's Executive Vice President of Policy and their Chief Economist, and he's talking to us from the land of make-believe, otherwise known as our nation's capital. Jonathan, it's good to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me back, as always, Mark. And yes, the land of make-believe still exists. It hasn't changed, unfortunately, for the better since the last time we talked.
No. In fact, I think it's just gotten worse there since we actually started talking to you way back over 11 years ago. I mean, in my lifetime, I never imagined we would have a president where there appears to be plenty of evidence that he and his family took bribes from foreign governments while president and not have both parties and the mainstream media be all over that. I just could not have imagined this. And yet not one elected Democrat that I know of has stepped forward and said that these are pretty serious crimes. We really ought to be looking at this. And the only reporter on the mainstream media side that I'm aware of that's looking at this is Catherine Herridge, and that's it. But Washington really seems to have devolved into a moral cesspool beyond anything that I could have possibly have imagined back when we first started talking. But you've been there this whole time. Did you see this coming, or has this surprised even people that have lived there in the thick of things?
Well, I think in a couple of ways, Mark, it surprised those of us who have even been here for a while as to just kind of how bad things have gotten from the D.C. gridlock perspective and just, you know, to your point, some of the lack of ethics or morality that's happened here and continues to get worse. Just the other day, I was looking at the national debt clock, for instance, and this is something that I think last time we talked, you know, we talked about, hey, this really the approaching, you know, $32 trillion of national debt that was this, you know, looming issue, and I hadn't checked it in a number of weeks here, and I went to check it here earlier today, and here we are as a nation now, as taxpayers, staring down the barrel of a national debt that now is $32,605,000,000,000. Wow. And, you know, I thought this was some error on the National Debt Clock website. But, you know, clearly we have added nearly $1 trillion more. Yes. In national debt. Yeah. since the last time we've talked.
Yeah, in 5 weeks. In the 5 weeks since that debt ceiling agreement, we've added $1 trillion to that debt. It's just astonishing. And, you know, I guess in some ways it shouldn't surprise anyone that when our political leaders have given in to immorality, they will also give away other people's money without a second thought. And, you know, you look at something like the Inflation Reduction Act, it was really just the New Green Deal with a new name. And according to Al Gore, in that bill, there was over $630 billion of that roughly $1 trillion deal that was earmarked for global warming. You know, I've lost track since Biden took over. How many trillions above and beyond normal government spending have we spent the last 3 years?
No, it's unbelievable, right? And when you look at these numbers, I think the problem is a lot of people's eyes glaze over when you see like a million here, a billion here, a trillion here, right? And you look at the magnitude. But, you know, breaking it down per person, let's say, which I think is the handiest way to do this, is per taxpayer in the United States, we are now looking at more than $253,000 that each one of us as taxpayers owe to pay off this national debt. That's not talking about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. No. That's, you know, $100+ trillion right. in unfunded liabilities in those programs. We're just talking about the current national debt after the debt deal, so the supposed debt deal that went down here. You know, that is, you know, almost $100,000 per citizen, for man, woman, and child. I mean, so we are talking about massive numbers here, and we absolutely have to start, you know, stop. Yeah, well, I guess the first issue is how do you get out of a hole, right? Right, stop digging it deeper and looking at ways that we can get there. We've talked about it multiple times. There's some great solutions at the state level of states that actually can balance their budget, keep their fiscal sanity intact, and actually deliver the things that they need to deliver as core government services for their people.
Well, it's astonishing to think that we are literally hundreds of trillions of dollars in debt when you add in Social Security and Medicaid and all these other things, and at the state level as well. You've got places like California that have dug their holes pretty deeply. Back in 1980, when Reagan famously posed the question, are you better off now than when you were 4 years ago? And pretty much everybody said no. So are we better off now than we were 3 years ago? Because the Biden team seems to think so, and that we're all just doing swell.
Well, that's an interesting observation, right? And I was actually just thinking about that. My good friend Andy Puzder, often on his Twitter account, will post the actual real wages in the Biden tenure here in Washington, D.C. as president. And up until just recently, as inflation came down, at least this recent print of 3% inflation, which some people think we're out of the woods, and I don't think we're out of the woods yet. There's lots of other, you know, problems on the horizon. But almost every period that was measured from, you know, nearly the start of the Biden administration up until the present, we have actually fallen behind on real wages, because as wages are going up, there's no doubt about that in nominal terms. And this is what the Biden White House tries to sell to the American people. That, look at your wages are going up, but that's only one half of the story, as we know. The real wages have actually been declining, because while wages are going up, they're not going up quickly enough to match this historic inflation that we've seen up until just recently. So I think that's the real story, is actually most Americans are less better off, worse off, and they've become poorer because of the inflation that's gone right. over the last 3 years.
Right, absolutely. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Last more to talk about with Jonathan Williams of ALEC coming up. We're going to be talking more about Bidenomics. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking with Jonathan Williams today, talking about Bidenomics and getting a better understanding of what's going on in the economy. Jonathan is the Executive Vice President of Policy for ALEC and their Chief Economist. ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can find out more about them and their terrific work that they do, including their 2023 Essential Policies Solutions. Highly recommend reading that by visiting alec.org. That's ALEC.org. And Jonathan, you know, getting back to that Reagan quote of, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? I don't think that we are better off than we were 3 years ago. But what are the key measurable differences that would prove or disprove whether people are better off now than before Biden took office? And I say that because, you know, you're famously from the land of make-believe. But when it comes to listening to like the press secretary and stuff, they just seem to make up numbers. And so what would be the key, those key differences that would prove things one way or the other?
Well, I would say we'd look at a couple of different factors. One I alluded to in the last segment, and that is the issue of real wages, right? I mean, this is kind of the key individual marker there is, yes, you may be getting paid more to compensate for inflation, but is it actually compensating for inflation, or is your real buying power going down? And it turns out when you look at the aggregate of it, for the vast majority of this administration, real wages have actually been going down. So from an individual perspective, from a microeconomics perspective, you know, this is, I think, one of the most important factors. It's one that I think people clearly feel, they see, and it's something that I think they'll feel when they go into the 2024 cycle here and think about who they and what vision they would like for this country going forward, both from a national perspective as well as a state perspective. The other, you know, element of this is, you know, how indebted are we, and as we've talked mm-hmm. about, and that has gone up tremendously over the last several years. And of course, even during the Trump administration, debt went up. And this has been a bipartisan problem of overspending now for decades, and it's been something that we need to fix in a holistic way, whether that's looking at things like the states do, like Colorado's Taxpayers Bill of Rights, which is tremendous taxpayer protection in its state's constitution that limits the growth of government spending. Even the Swiss in Europe have a Swiss debt brake, they call it, which is another mechanism that they've used to, over a business cycle, ensure that government doesn't grow faster than the private sector, because, you know, how is this ability to pay happen? It's because government extracts resources right from the private sector and from individuals. So, you know, that's another key metric. And then the other one, coming out of the pandemic, we should have been seeing far greater GDP growth or growth of the overall economy. We should have been seeing makeup GDP growth in the, you know, maybe 3.5-4% concentrated. And of course, we haven't been seeing that when you look at the GDP numbers coming in quarter by quarter. In fact, we've been teetering on the edge, and there was the whole debate that we talked about in the previous conversation, Mark, about, you know, are we in a recession or not, right? There was that whole debate of redefining from the Biden administration what a recession meant.
Right, right.
And was it two consecutive quarters of negative growth or not, right? And we saw negative growth. We saw very stagnant growth while we should have been seeing robust growth coming out of the pandemic. So in my mind, there's others to look at, of course. Those would be three of the key measures right there. And I think this administration is failing on all three of them.
Well, absolutely they are. And you're right. They changed the definition of a recession, and pretty much like they changed the definition of what a vaccine was in order to make it look like it's safe and effective. But getting back to the national debt there, why isn't that $100 trillion Social Security and other unfunded liabilities, why are they not considered or counted as part of the national debt?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, this gets somewhat of a nuanced discussion between debt and what is an unfunded liability that's a promise, right, to pay in the future.
This sounds like a Clinton, what's the definition of is? Type thing.
Yeah, what is, Mark? Yeah, really. And, you know, we are going to be obligated to pay that unless we see huge rollbacks to the program, which I think is very, you know, unlikely as we go forward. Although I do think we need to have a discussion of younger workers coming into Social Security, let's say. I think one of the, you know, like his policies or not, I think one of the great things and the courage showed by the George W. Bush administration in this regard was to allow individual accounts. You remember that debate around 2005, I think it was, when that administration put a lot of their political capital on the line and then had to take back the proposal to allow younger workers coming into the workforce to devote a portion of their Social Security taxes towards individual accounts that they could put into investments in a limited way that would give them more upside potential. Because I think historically speaking, as a student of history, Mark, you know this, I mean, the return on Social Security is somewhere it's a de minimis return of somewhere in the 1-2% range, where you look at the average over a 50-year period, you could expect to at least double that in conservative broad-based investing across the portfolio at the very least.
Right.
And so, you know, things like that, I think, are really, you know, key to be talking about. And I think that as people are looking at potential presidential runs here in 24 and otherwise, I think it's a mistake to take those big issues off the table. We cannot have a national discussion around how we turn our economy and around and have a real discussion around our national debt and liabilities unless we have some of these discussions. That's going to take political courage from and Republicans need to come to the table, Democrats need to come to the table, and we need to discuss what's good for new workers coming forward while honoring the promises that we've made to retirees.
Well, it just doesn't seem like well, first of all, the Republicans are pretty reluctant to address this. But on the other side, the Democrats seem completely unwilling to address this. And the problem is when the Democrats get into office, things end up getting worse financially, not better. And so I think the only way they come to the table is if they're really, really out of power by a big margin, both House and Senate, and they've lost the presidency as well. So maybe you could get a few of them to the table. I don't know. I'm having a hard time envisioning a time when the Democrats would want to actually fix the problem. So what do you think would bring them to the table?
Well, I think, Mark, the progressives here in Washington are going to demand major tax increases, right, as part of a discussion. And that is inherently part of the fault lines right now is, you know, Republicans would like to see some structural reforms, at least those that are open-minded to addressing these issues. As I mentioned, there are Republicans out there that don't want to touch what I think is one of the existential issues facing us as a nation going forward, and our kids and our grandkids for that matter. And I think that's a mistake not addressing it. But the way that I've seen folks on the left look to address it is, well, let's just take out the cap of earnings on Social Security and tax those above that level more and make those earnings subject to Social Security taxes, among other new taxes that have been proposed, right? I mean, there's already been tax increases in Medicare and Medicaid taxes with the FICA, and we've seen those taxes go up anyways. But, you know, that's part of the issue. And, of course, that's a non-starter for many Republicans to raise taxes. And I think that's right. We don't need to raise any more taxes as a nation, right? Yes. We're already collecting and have for a number of years record federal tax revenue. We don't need more revenue. We need to address the liabilities. We need to address the overspending.
Right. I was just going to say, just cut the spending and let's start making headway that way. Okay, let's go take a break. Still lots more to talk about Bidenomics. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about Bidenomics today. We're doing that with Jonathan Williams. He's the Executive Vice President for Policy at ALEC and their Chief Economist. And Jonathan, the last time that we had talked was the first week of March, and the debt ceiling debate was just really beginning to heat up at that point. On the one side, Biden and the Democrats wanted to increase the debt ceiling and no questions asked, basically zero spending cuts. And on the other side, McCarthy seemed to want to force some spending cuts there. And then all of a sudden, McCarthy just suddenly reversed and essentially gave the Democrats practically everything that Biden wanted. And I think that shocked a lot of people. They tried to make it out like they had gotten some big concessions and stuff, and I didn't really see that. But let's talk about this, the debt that the federal government has with this whole debt ceiling. Is this different than any other kind of debt that the average taxpayer would have? For example, they've got a credit card, and they've got a maximum limit of $10,000, and so they've reached that point. They've maxed out their credit card, and they can either ask for an increase and keep spending, or they could keep that limit and continue paying the interest, or maybe even cut other spending. But, most people don't want to do that. But as long as they keep paying the interest, they haven't defaulted on anything. They just can't borrow any more than they already have. So is that a fair comparison to this debt ceiling debate, or is there something inherently different about the type of debt that the federal government has?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty good analogy there, Mark. I'm sure there's some technical differences if you talk to some of the budget writers here in Washington that they'd quibble around the edges there. But I mean, it's not all that different in concept, right? Or the concept of an interest-only mortgage, right? And you think you can afford it, and then you realize the principal payments are going to come due, and you can't, right? And so it was a big test. I mean, I think on one hand, I mean, this is a very narrow majority for Republicans, clearly, in historic terms. And there were a lot of factions within that caucus to try to so-called, you know, the herding cats, I think is the phrase that Trent Lott once coined here in Washington, D.C., that is probably appropriate to that situation.
Yeah, and I think, you know, on one hand, it's probably a little bit more like herding cats while trying to shave them and give them a bath.
That's about right. Yeah. I'm sure Kevin McCarthy would agree. But that being said, you know, I think this was a big test of can Kevin McCarthy keep the Republican conference together in a way that would pass something, whether you like the policy or not. I think if he would have failed in this regard of keeping folks together and getting to a majority, it would have been all bets off for the next, you know, year and a half as they wrap up this current Congress term. And there's, you know, obviously some discussions over, did this really change the trajectory on spending? No. it didn't, and some probably oversold it. But on the other hand, you know, this was a probably a good thing in the short term to be able to keep Republicans together. The question is, you know, this is not something that's a policy goal that you can actually, you know, say is a victory on a policy basis, I think, for in a major victory.
Well, one of the things that we kept hearing during that whole debate, and have in pretty much every debt ceiling debate I have ever heard about, is that we had to raise the debt or we would default on our loans. Using that example above, why couldn't they just stop borrowing like the average Joe? And so I guess that begs the question, are we paying our debts with more debts? Because otherwise, I don't see why we couldn't just stop borrowing at that point.
That's right. I mean, that was a total straw man argument, right, from Janet Yellen and others, that we're using it to bring people to the table and try to force them into a binary choice of yes or no of raising the debt ceiling. And unfortunately, it played out the way that they envisioned it, right? I mean, people were scared. They were going to the mainstream media, and of course, the big corporate mainstream media was all reporting on that talking point and not even questioning the underlying premise. But your point is a good one. It's one that I've made. It's one that, you know, many others have made, that is, no, we would not default on debt. In fact, if you remember the discussion that even Speaker Boehner then at the time had with then President Obama, they actually made instructions in order how the payments would be made to not default on the debt, so there wouldn't be any threat to U.S. credit worthiness or any default where we would, you know, have a major economic meltdown. This was all a strategy, and unfortunately it was successful in some respects by Janet Yellen and the Biden White House in order to scare people into this debate without having the better and bigger discussion, which is how much should we be spending as a country, and are we needing to add more spending and add more debt to continue to fuel the spending addiction? And unfortunately, we chose to raise the debt ceiling right now and not have that underlying discussion.
So just to be clear, if McCarthy had said, you know, absolutely no, we're not going to increase that debt ceiling at all, what would have happened? I mean, would we have defaulted on the loans, or that was, you know, like in that credit card example, we just would have hit that ceiling, we can't borrow anymore?
Well, I mean, the issue is you can redirect payments, you can stop spending in other areas to free up the cash flow. I mean, this is lots of ways where you can avoid it, or you can do what Boehner and Obama did and give instructions on, based on all the tax revenue that's coming in, what gets paid first, and we pay the interest and principal of the debt first, so we don't have this catastrophic default scenario. That's pretty straightforward in how you can avoid it that way. I mean, this gets back to when we talk about budgeting. I mean, this is exactly the kind of tactics that at the state and federal level are often used. We call it Washington Monument budgeting. And what you remember during some of the government shutdowns in years past, one of the first things that got shut down, the National Park Service put, you know, actually spent man hours and put barricades around the World War II Memorial to stop our veterans from coming to see the memorial, right? Yeah. And they wanted to say that, you know, this is the only thing we can do because government shut down. I mean, it's completely backwards thinking. And once again, proves my point that Washington is the land of make-believe.
Yeah. Well, just thinking about how we are just flushing this money down the toilet as fast as we can, you know, it makes my head hurt. And I kind of wonder if a lot of times these congressmen and senators just look at this, well, we're already $32 trillion in debt. What's another couple trillion? And they just sort of throw up their hands and just are done with the fight and just give in.
Well, to paraphrase the former governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour, who I think coined this, I mean, a billion here, a billion there. Turns out sooner or later you get the real money. Yeah. Now it's a trillion here, a trillion there, Mark, unfortunately.
Yes, I've thought that exact same thing. Okay, let's go and take a break a little bit early. Come back. We're going to be continuing our discussion about Bidenomics with Jonathan Williams. Stay with us. Back this is the Ask Bide Radio Show. We're talking about what's going on in the broader economy, which sometimes feels like it's more about driving a political and sexual agenda, more so than anything to do with business. And we're talking with Jonathan Williams. He's the chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council, where he is also their vice president of policy. Find out more about ALEC at ALEC.org. And Jonathan, it's not just our military, sadly enough, that's going woke. It's infesting the whole of government, it seems. And so many elements of our economy, Bud Light famously crashed and burned, and dozens of other companies are pushing a sexual agenda rather than focus on things like good products. And Disney, which has been pushing sex at kids along with a whole laundry list of woke agenda, has lost billions of dollars over the last year or two. And Bob Iger recently indicated that Disney may have to sell off some TV assets like ABC and other networks. He then later backtracked a bit, but it appears that really is on the table. So what is it with these major corporations that get successful and then run away from what made them successful in the first place?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, we have a pretty good front row seat at some of these battles playing out at the mm-hmm. state level with some of these companies. I mean, you mentioned Disney. That was a big battle this last legislative session, obviously, and Governor DeSantis in Florida taking the lead to revoke what was kind of a special, you know, privilege there that they had with their development district. And of course, there's been the back and forth on this, and it's gotten to be somewhat silly season now, where Disney even just made the announcement recently, if I read the news correctly, that they were going to at least consider moving new development of construction and new employees to California from Florida, which is just remarkable to me, and how backwards that thinking must be that California seems attractive all of a sudden to a company. But, you know, as an organization such as ours, that, you know, we work with principled businesses that, you know, are stand up for free markets, and the ones that are involved with ALEC are just outstanding mm-hmm. in so many ways of, you know, standing up for lower taxes and limited government and working with our state legislators. And then seeing so just some of these unforced errors out there that you referenced in your examples, and there's obviously, you know, so many to list that we wouldn't have time to get to all of them in the show today. But it does beg the question of, you know, what happened to focusing on building a business, taking care of shareholders, workers, consumer, you know, the customers of the company, the basic things that build value for the company. You know, what happened to that is the forethought. Yes. I mean, I think Peter Drucker and the management, you know, the gurus of his day would be rolling in their grave right now if they saw what was happening and just the value that's being destroyed because some of these politically charged statements. You know, how about focusing on profits versus focusing on putting these political ideas ahead of that? And, yes. you know, at the bottom line, you know what you're going to get into in this day and age. You get into politics, whether you go to the right, which these big, you know, publicly traded companies don't do, and they're scared of that, but they will go to the left in some cases. And so, you know, they should know, if they've seen this examples of Disney and Bud Light and all the others, that there is a real cost today to putting politics ahead of profitability.
Yes. Yeah. You know, a lot of companies tend to imitate other companies when they're successful at something, you know, whether it's a new manufacturing technique or management styles or maybe product lines. Are there any examples out there that you can think of where companies have gone full woke and disavowed their traditional values, not to mention pro-American values, and actually seen an improvement in their bottom line because they went woke? Because I can't think of any.
I can't think of any off the top of my head. And that, I mean, that's telling in itself, right? I mean, the basic management concepts is that you should focus on shareholder value and focus on the things that build value and grow your company. I mean, this is a no-brainer. I mean, this is like, you know, not rocket surgery, as Art Laffer always likes to say. This is basic financial management of a company and basic business 101.
Well, you know, we were talking earlier about all the money being bled off from taxpayers and all of this spending that's going on under Bidenomics. And I recall an article, I don't know if I can find it in time for this weekend's show page, but I recall reading not too long ago that there have been multiple examples of companies that are startups, and they were handed cash either under COVID or under the whole green energy deal or this latest Inflation Reduction Act, which has very little to do with inflation reduction. And they were taking millions of dollars from the government under the promise of developing this or doing that, and they never did anything. They never created a single product, and yet they got all that millions, and then they went bankrupt. And I just see, again, getting back to Bidenomics as a whole, it just seems like let's spend as much money from the federal government bleeding off taxpayer dollars and not caring about those products, like not caring about the deliverables that a normal business model should have.
Well, I'm right. I mean, this is the inherent kind of the fatal conceit of central planning, right, is that you think that government knows best about where to direct these investments, right? And it turns out that government makes decisions not on business practices or economic best practices, but on political best practices. And you know, if we look at this, the clown car that is the spending disaster here in Washington, D.C., and it's not surprising that they're choosing a lot of losers when it comes to where to direct these funds. funds. And if there's no underlying value creation strategy, or if these companies are more concerned about making political statements than they are actually growing a business and making money for exactly. their employees and shareholders, I mean, this is not a big surprise why we're having this issue. I mean, and this I was just recently asked to try to define what Bidenomics is, right? My friend Kevin Stocklin over at the Epoch Times asked me this for his recent story. And I think it does revolve around this idea of it's really trickled down big government mm-hmm. and government trying to pick winners and losers. And it turns out, you know, government's not going to beat the market in picking winners and losers. It just doesn't happen that way.
Well, when you can take millions of dollars as a company promising that you're going to develop some product line or some other kind of global warming stuff, and you can get millions from the taxpayer from that and then default on it. We used to call that kind of thing corruption. We used to call that, you know, basically theft, really. But this seems to be their business model now. You don't need to produce anything because the government's just going to hand you money.
That's right. It's a moral hazard issue, right? And you know, if you fail, the taxpayers are going to be used. The taxpayer dollars are going to be used to shore you up. I mean, it's the kind of the old story about, you know, if you put enough government money towards something, you can do anything, right? I mean,
right.
And the old example is if you want to grow oranges in the state of Maine, you can do so if you get enough government taxpayer support to do so. The question is, are you creating anything of value, and is it scalable, and is it long-term lasting, right? I mean, as soon as the federal dollar go away, it turns out that many of these things are just going to go away as well. And, you know, there may be a few isolated examples you could point to say, well, something made it because of these startup dollars. But chances are, if the business plan was good enough in the first place, you could go to private markets and actually raise the money for that business idea.
Yep, exactly. Okay, let's go and take a break. More on Bidenomics with Jonathan Williams. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking with Jonathan Williams. He's the chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council and also their vice president of policy there. You can find out more about their terrific work at alec.org, A-L-E-C.org. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well on today's show page, which is 13-29. And Jonathan, we were talking about woke in that last segment there, and also this notion that you can just bleed off money from the taxpayer and that's your business model, and who cares if you ever actually do anything with it. You've just got the money and that's good enough. But, you know, there has been a little bit of a shift away from things like ESG and DEI and the rest. And before we went on air, you were talking about Vanguard as being one of these companies that is starting to say, maybe we ought to start looking in different directions there. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, it was. I thought it was a great example recently in the Wall Street Journal, where their CEO's comments were picked up, and he's been, you know, out talking about why, you know, as a company, Vanguard is looking as an index fund, you know, as a big product of theirs at broad-based investing, and let's keep politically based investing out of things, right? And that's the point that we've been trying to make this last, you know, year or more now at the state level, as we've developed model policy, as you know, Mark, to keep politics out of pensions, whether it's ESG or other politics. I mean, these state pension funds are trillions of dollars underfunded. The last thing we need to do is insert more politics and less profitability into the equation. And so it's really refreshing because there's been so many actors out there in both the pension systems and private sector entities even that have, you know, said we want ESG to be our goal, a huge goal, and signing out of these global agreements of net zero and other things by 2050 or 2030 in some cases, or some very unrealistic goals, right? And so to have a major leader in that space, an investment space, and the CEO of Vanguard coming out to say, you know, we're going to focus on returns as a company and focus on broad-based long-term returns. Awfully a bit of refreshing, bit of fresh air there when it comes to this debate that has gotten so heated.
Yes.
And these firms have become, in many cases, so beholden to these international agreements that are being signed, right? I mean, and so I thought that was just good. It deserves, I think, the appreciation of those that are in this for kind of the right ideas that are saying, hey, we need to keep politics out of the equation. I'm sure they took a lot of heat from the progressive left for saying we're not going to be a part of some of these net zero agreements and we just want to focus on profitability. But I think it's awfully nice to see a CEO step out there and say the right thing. And I'm looking forward to seeing that to play out, hopefully with many more companies going forward.
Well, I would hope so. It just, you know, looking at the whole of Bidenomics, it just seems like with these hundreds of billions of dollars, it's almost like big business is seeing big government as a giant slush fund. And when I look at this, it seems to come down to making the big guys bigger and strangling the little guys until there's no more of them. You know, we saw it with COVID lockdowns where the mom and pops, they had to shut down, but the big stores got to stay open. And guess what happened? A lot of those moms and pops went out of business and they're no longer with us. And I saw a really interesting video that I'm going to put up on this week's show page. And again, it's 13-29. We're seeing this in the banking sector too. And this is a brief little 3.5 minute video. And he talks about the big four mega banks made $30 billion in profits in the first quarter, while the small community banks were barely making any profits at all. And it's due largely, he says, due to both different regulations for the too big to fail versus the small banks, and also in how the Fed is pushing its interest rates. And just to give you an example, J.P. Morgan was highlighted. He said they had a net profit of 35% in the first quarter. And as part of that, they had gotten $50 billion from the taxpayer to gobble up First Republic, which has already delivered them $2.7 billion in pure profit, which they get to keep, along with hundreds of millions of dollars of ongoing profits on assets that they acquired in that deal for pennies on the dollar. So now compare that to what community banks are facing. They're down 30% since March, and some of them are expecting, some organizations like Wall Street Journal and others are expecting the small banks are probably due for a loss of up to 23% in the coming quarter. As I said, he blames it on the Fed rate hikes and how they're handling it, because the big banks are able to offer 0.01% on a checking account, but then they take that money and turn around and lend that for 8.25%, thanks to the Fed. In other words, they get a profit of 825 times. But again, those rules are very small, different from smaller banks. So can you talk to us about how these regulations are hurting not just banks, but all of the small guys across the states?
Well, right. I mean, this is a classic problem with regulation, right? It tends to hurt the smaller players, whatever market that may be. So the NFIB, you know, members, the mom and pops all across the country are more adversely affected by the COVID restrictions that you mentioned, right, where they were deemed non-essential. And it was travesty what happened during the government lockdowns at the state and local level. You look at whether it's banks or other industries. I mean, right, the regional banks have also taken it pretty hard over the last year or so, and even ones that were not directly connected to some sort of an ESG or woke style issue that hit Silicon Valley Bank, right? But with others that just got hit by the interest rate changes that were basically a consequence of all this big government spending that we've been talking about today. That was one of the key drivers of it, one that was probably not made that connection as clearly as we should across the country, is it is this big government agenda, the racking up of national debt, and the inflation that then caused this interest rate rise that then caught a lot of people by surprise. Probably shouldn't have caught people by surprise given we know where the fundamentals were, but it certainly did. But yeah, this is a classic issue of regulation. It's going to hurt the smaller players. But you know, let's not forget that there is a broad-based really attack against financial companies from the left, from the Elizabeth Warren crowd of the progressive left in Washington, whether it's legislation. But one of the more concerning areas, I think, is the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the CFPB that was, of course, helped to be created by Elizabeth Warren, and all the other federal agencies that are really pushing the envelope to overregulate, whether it's small, medium-sized, or large banks across the country. And so, yeah, I think the small guys get hit more by regulation in a lot of ways across different industries. But at the same time, there is a broadside right now from the progressive wing of Congress and by the regulatory agencies against financial services across the board.
Yeah. You know, I just looking at what's happened here, I think the Biden administration has taken picking winners and losers to a whole new level to squeeze out competition rather than encourage it. I think we've moved from capitalism to what I like to think of as monopolism, because that's where they're headed. Okay, let's take a break. Coming up, we're going to wrap things up with Jonathan Williams. We're going to be talking about Oregon and where they are now in the rich states, poor states rankings. Stay with us. And welcome back in our final segment now with Jonathan Williams. He's the Executive Vice President of Policy and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. He's also the co-author of Rich States, Poor States, an annual report by ALEC of competition among the states and a ranking of their economic outlook. You can get a copy at richstatespoorstates.org. And Jonathan, the last time we talked, the 16th edition came out after we talked. So how did Oregon do?
Well, that's not going to surprise you or your listeners, Mark, but not well. I mean, once again, in the bottom 10, an economic outlook in rich states, poor states, which, as you recall, is looking at 15 different factors such as taxes and labor regulations and spending at the state level, things that we know matter for economic growth and health of a state. And so coming in at 43rd this year was Oregon, falling a couple of spots from last year while retaining its bottom 10 status.
Yeah, that really doesn't surprise anyone that lives here in Oregon that we've dropped a couple. I just did a quick glance through it on the kind of the summary page. And when you look at that, Oregon is not doing well. And the only thing that we do seem to be doing well is that we continue to not have a sales tax yet, although they are trying to they keep trying to take that away. But that doesn't help much when you are so heavily taxed that you have so little to spend anyway. Would we be better off with a sales tax and no income tax?
Well, I was going to say the one thing Oregon does well is stay slightly ahead of California, right? And that's what probably matters the most, California coming in at 45th. But yeah, to your question, Mark, is, you know, I think that, you know, I'm not an advocate for creating a sales tax if you still had an income tax on the books. But I do think when you look at it in our 16 years of research, there are five states that do without a state sales tax. There's nine states to do without a state income tax. And when you look at the overall growth trajectory of those groups of states, it's pretty clear that it's more advantageous to be a no income tax state right. than it is to be a no sales tax state. When you look at growth of income, whether you look at growth of jobs, whether you look at the interstate migration of individuals and businesses across state lines, which is one of the key factors, of course, in our rich states, poor states report. If I had a magic wand, Mark, and I had to create a state from scratch or create a state tax code from scratch, there is no way I would rely heavily on an income tax.
Yeah. Yeah, and to be clear, I was not saying we need to add a sales tax in addition to the income tax. I was saying, should we swap those and have either or? But in terms
well, it's
of...
like the debate in Washington, you know, it often gets these folks that want to repeal the income tax in Washington and have, let's say, a fair tax of a national sales tax. That's a whole another debate. But usually the disingenuous political ads come out and say, well, individual X wants the 23% sales tax without mentioning the fact that they get rid of their income tax. So that's it's an important piece. Mm-hmm. And then obviously at the federal level, you'd have to repeal the 16th Amendment to the Constitution that allowed for an income tax in the first place to make sure it was, you know, unconstitutional, because I think if you make that swap, it's got to be a hard swap, and you can't go back and have both, clearly. Right. That would be the biggest problem.
Right. So looking at what Oregon has not done well to drop two spots, what are some things that we could maybe focus the most attention on that would have the most benefit?
Well, I mean, the things that, I think probably stand out as being some of the bigger problems are, you know, some of the biggest issues that drive growth, unfortunately, and that is, you know, only, you know, one state has a higher personal income tax when you combine state and local. Only two states have higher corporate income taxes when you combine that. Of course, with gross receipts tax, just adding to the issues, you have one of the most progressive tax systems. Only California is more progressive as well, taxing those that are successful, right, for their earned success. And then the other thing that's just a major outlier, I would say, is the vast majority of states have moved away from having a death tax. And it's clearly something that drives people out of the state and gives them one more reason to go south and maybe for better weather in retirement years, is they want to be able to pass on their property and their wealth to their kids and their grandkids. And having a state-level inheritance and death tax is just something that's a economic killer for states that retain those things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those are a few things that stand out. There's obviously a lot more when you rank in the bottom 10 that should be considered, but I think those certainly are ones that should probably get the most attention.
Well, as I say, you can find the Oregon chart there at richstatespoorstates.org, and we'll link right up to that on ispyradio.com as well. Just looking at some of these other columns, we are 50th at that estate and inheritance tax that you mentioned, but somehow we also managed to land 50th in the right-to-work state categories. How do we end up at the very bottom on that one?
Well, that's a bit of a trick question on that one, because that's a yes or no question. And so you're number one if you have right to work, and you're number 50 if you don't have right to work. And but it turns out, I mean, this is a key area of economic growth for states that have adopted, you know, right to work laws in recent years. We've seen a big trend even in the industrial Midwest of many states. Scott Walker's Wisconsin, Mitch Daniels, of course, in Indiana helped lead the way. But now more recently, Kentucky and West Virginia in other states becoming right-to-work states as kind of a yes or no for employers,
so
right?
That,
and
so
there are
like
many
there's...
employers that say, oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so in that ranking, it's not like we've got different shades there. So there's you could have been 48th or something. It's just all you're either first or 50th.
Yeah, either you have a right-to-work law in the books or you don't. And obviously this gets back to not just economic development, but individual liberty and the rights of workers to say you should have your choice as an individual whether you'd like to belong to an organization or not as a condition of employment, right? As a membership organization, we don't say state legislators need to belong to ALEC. We say you can voluntarily join, right? I mean, that's the whole point of voluntary associations. But if you don't have a right-to-work law, you can be forced as a condition of employment to join a union and to give money to political causes that you don't like.
Yep. So real quick here, while Oregonians are suffering through financial issues, one problem after another, its largest city is becoming more anti-business. In the middle of all of that, Governor Kotek just doled out raises for government employees to the tune of 13% to 22% and includes a one-time $1,500 bonus to deal with inflation that the Democrats pretend the rest of us aren't feeling. I mean, this isn't a let them eat cake mentality. This is a let's have a picnic in the streets and we'll eat cake right in front of them while they look on and starve. Are other states doing things like that?
Well, we've seen it in some respects. I only half jokingly, maybe your governor ought to remind President Biden that there has been inflation after all. If these payments need to go out to compensate people for the inflation coming from Washington, D.C. I think we've seen, Mark, two different ways the states have handled it. One is this way. Another way, which has been, I think, the productive way of getting to the bottom of making people held harmless in a way from this horrible inflation is the idea that states are aggressively cutting tax rates and getting more money back into the hands of small businesses and hardworking taxpayers.
I would sure
and that's
like,
been an incredible thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would sure love to see that. Unfortunately, Jonathan, we're up against the time. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me back as always, Mark.
There was one bit of good news for Oregon that we didn't get to with Jonathan. It's not huge, and I doubt it's enough to move us up a notch in rich states, poor states. But Oregon did pass Senate Bill 498, a bipartisan bill that does ease the death tax. Not for everyone, just family farms, ranches, forests, and fishing estates. But it's a start. Although, why not for everyone? I mean, why is it that you die and the government thinks that you owe them money for the privilege of finally escaping their clutches? Death taxes are perhaps the most immoral of taxes because they're taxing you on money and property on which you already pay taxes, and now that you've died, you can't do anything about it. Now, property taxes are another thing. Why do you pay taxes on your house every year after you bought it? It should be a one-time sales tax. You don't keep paying a sales tax every year for the shoes you buy or your computer. Worse, a yearly property tax sends the wrong message, as if you're renting it from the government. The government doesn't own it. You do. We need to send the right people and the right message to government. Stop spending. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.